This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
There we go. Pepe Escobar, you were on my show a few years ago, and here we are in China, in the province of Xinjiang, and I cannot believe that I'm sitting here with one of the greatest journalists in the world.
Man, we are in Kashgar, in the middle of the hustle and bustle, on the second day of Golden Week. So this is a really, really special occasion. It's absolutely fascinating. And I've been longing to come here for a long time. I couldn't come before COVID. This trip at the moment was supposed to be in 2020.
Yes.
But now 2035 is the right moment for several reasons. And the way it was timed, the trip was after the SCO summit in Tianjin, which was quite something. The Victory Day parade in Beijing, commemorating the 80th anniversary of the Chinese victory over Japanese aggression. Very, very important. Started in 1931.
Gee.
And of course, the Asian chapter, the victory against Nazi fascism. And of course, after that, it felt natural to come to Xinjiang, which is not the last frontier, but one of the super frontiers of China in the 21st century in a national development project that started in 1999. The Chinese started the Go West campaign in 1999 to develop Xinjiang and Tibet, Xizang. And we are right in the middle of Xinjiang development in this trip. So it's to watch it firsthand and talking to Uyghurs locally, everywhere we've been, from Urumqi, the capital, to the top oases in the Northern Silk Road, the Southern Silk Road, all the way to Pamir lands, very close to the China-Pakistan border and the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. This is priceless at the moment. And we're very lucky to be here at this historical moment.
Yeah, so we've actually traveled all of this together. And one of the most mind-blowing experiences was driving through the Taklamakan Desert. 11 hours.
Well, I've been dreaming of this since for 15 years, if not more. When they built the first, now there are four roads and highways crossing the Taklamakan. We took probably the first one. And it started in 2007, 2008, and I was already, oh man, because I had read all those Western expeditions, and Russian and Japanese, that tried to cross the Taklamakan or cross the Taklamakan. And in the case of Sven Hedin, the Swedish explorer, he almost died trying to cross the Taklamakan. Everybody died. All the pack animals died except him and one of his assistants. He spent 6 days and five nights in the Taklamakan without water. So this in scholarly circles in the West, this is myth. This is one of the top myths of Western exploring of Xinjiang. Well, but this is Western exploring. They have been living like this here, side by side with Taklamakan for over 2,000 years. For them, Taklamakan is absolutely normal. So when the Silk Road started to develop from the beginning, Han Dynasty, 2nd century BC, they started to say, okay, we need a trail, a northern trail, which became the Northern Silk Road, and a southern trail, which became the Southern Silk Road. We were lucky enough to start in the Northern Trail, cross the Taklamakan, and continue on the Southern Trail. So we did at least 50% of the Northern and Southern Silk Roads on our trip. That's a blessing.
So I started this conversation by saying that you're one of the greatest journalists. I think in the sense that you still actually do journalism. You go somewhere, you don't sit behind a computer. Do you think
I could never do it.
Yeah. I mean, do you think this is a problem with modern journalism?
Yeah. Well, I am a nomad pilgrim. Mm. I consider myself an observer, a traveler, a nomad pilgrim. a student, especially in Eurasia. I made a decision to move to live in Asia in 1994. This means 31 years ago. I had already been a correspondent in the West. I became a foreign correspondent exactly 40 years ago, in fact.
Really?
Yes, this is a very long story. I've been playing this game for very long. My first post was London in 1985. And before, I am a newspaper guy as well. I started in the newspaper business in a big national newspaper. So this is a microcosm in itself. It's a cutthroat environment. You have to learn how to navigate the environment. Shock of eagles, of course.
Hey, look what's
lots right. of people.
Look what was has
oh,
there we
fantastic.
Go.
Cheche.
Cheche. And we have local beer. This is
Yeah, this is what you wanted. You wanted the local.
I did.
Now you're getting it. But this is the best way, it was the best way in the past to learn how the newspaper business works. So I learned everything about the newspaper business inside a big national newspaper. The pressures, how to deal with the owners, how to displease the owners, because one of my specialities. And of course, I wanted to be a foreign correspondent from the beginning.
Why?
Because it's that ideal mix in the mind of a serial nomad to travel the world and tell the world what you see on the spot, which was the purpose of the old school foreign correspondent, which is my, let's say, dwindling and disappearing profession. I'm one of the last ones.
Yeah.
Most of my friends and colleagues older than me, they're all dead, practically no exceptions. And many of my age, they're retired. I have some very good friends in Europe. They retired in disgust. They were working for some of the major European papers, and then one day they said, some of them sued their newspaper. They were lucky enough at least to get some compensation. Some just left because they couldn't stand it anymore. And others left because they knew they could not exercise their profession like in the old days. In my case, I was extremely lucky because I made the transition to online media relatively early, in 2000, 25 years ago.
That's early.
That's very early when you look at the arc of of the media business, right?
Yes.
So in 2000 itself, I joined Asia Times in Hong Kong. So I stayed with them for 20 years on and off.
2000?
Yes, I joined in late 2000.
Okay, but now, this is interesting.
Mm.
So very, very soon after you joined, if I have my timeline correct, 9/11 happened. That must have changed a lot of things.
Jeremy, you have no idea. Really, this would take a whole day here in the bazaar trying to explain. The shock for the media business and the shock for this little tiny website in Hong Kong that nobody knew about because they were relaunched at the time when I joined. It's interesting for our audience to have a little bit of the background of Asia Times. They started as a big newspaper in 1985. I remember very well, I was in Singapore, and one day in Singapore, I saw this beautiful old school newspaper, black and white photos splashed on the front page, wonderful typology. I said, well, who are these guys? And then when I looked around, I said, printed in Bangkok, Singapore, and Hong Kong. I said, wow.
Gee.
So when I started to get information about them, I learned that their, let's say, their mission, we're going to fight the Wall Street Journal Asia and the Financial Times here in Asia, and we're going to win because we're going to tell the Asia story, which was the biggest story of the 1980s and 1990s from an Asian point of view, with some Westerners as well. The guys who set up the paper, they were a mix of Thais, and there were two Thais especially, and one German-American. They set up Asia Times. And the guy who owned Asia Times, Sondi Lintongu, we later became very good friends. He was a media entrepreneur and also had, he had a mini empire in Thailand. The problem is, this was 1995. 1997, the Asian financial crisis started, which was, when you think about it, historic, was crazy. I had spent 1 month in Hong Kong covering the Hong Kong handover. The night of the Hong Kong handover, when the Brits left, we went to a club called 1997 and we partied all night long. But we had an 8 o'clock morning flight to Xi'an in China. So we went straight to the airport. I was with a Singaporean girlfriend. And this was the day that the baht crisis started and the Asian financial crisis started. So when the financial crisis started, I was here in China and I was doing the old Silk Road from Xi'an. And I came here for the first time in 1997. So when I, and then I came back again in 1998. So when I looked at Kashgar compared to what I had seen 25 years ago, I almost had a heart attack yesterday and today.
So, yeah, because wow. You said it looks a bit more like Disneyland.
Yes, there is a Disneylandification process. One of the good things, at least that we learned here, is that where we are in the old city, at least, I wouldn't say most, but a great deal of the original old city homes were preserved. And we asked around a lot. The owners are still here. And in many cases, they rent their house or part of their house for businesses. This is the good part. And others that were offered compensation by the government to move and live somewhere else, probably got a good deal, and they are living somewhere else in Kashgar. But can you imagine, you and our audience, what it was traveling in Xinjiang in 1997, 1998, before 9/11, and in a totally free manner? I didn't have to show my passport anywhere. Mm. I just jumped into a train, at the moment, slow trains, a back of a Jeep, local buses and all that, with no problem
whatsoever.
Yeah, security
now is a bit tighter.
There was practically no security at the time, which is something that later on the Chinese started to pay attention, because these Uyghurs that were they were completely brainwashed by Salafi jihadism financed by Persian Gulf monarchies, they would sooner or later provoke extreme trouble in China.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, led in 2001, in June 2001, 3 months before 9/11, to the creation of the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, sure, which in the beginning was Russia, China, and three Central Asian stands. And in a very Chinese way, they had to fight against what they called the three evils: terrorism, extremism, and separatism. And this started in Shanghai. It was a small pagoda in a garden in Shanghai, something very low-key at the time. 3 months later,
the gangs.
9/11 happened.
And then the gangs.
Exactly. Mm. And all that, I tell you all that because this links directly with Asia Times. Mm. When I joined, like I told you, was this tiny website in Hong Kong. There were two or three people in Hong Kong in a small room, and three people in Thailand, in Bangkok, in a beautiful palace by the river owned by our protector, Sondi. And then this was a stroke of luck, but also has to do with journalistic instinct. I was in Afghanistan before 9/11. And our Karachi correspondent, Salim, a wonderful guy, after 9/11, we were working in tandem. Salim was in Karachi and I was in Islamabad, Peshawar. And we're talking every day what we were doing. And then we started to get this huge audience in the U.S. especially, say, look, there is this tiny little thing in Hong Kong. There are two guys over there. They're in the middle of everything. We're lucky because we were here before. So, and this made the popularity of Asia Times especially in the US, Canada, and let's say Asia hands everywhere. Everybody who spoke English or read in English started to read us because we were in the middle of the whole thing, Pakistan, tribal areas, Afghanistan. So this was, like I told you, it was a stroke of luck, but at the same time, I had been to Afghanistan before, and this why I was here in 2001 before 9/11, because I was trying to interview Massoud, Commander Massoud in the Panjshir Valley. I was with my British photographer, wonderful friend. He was living in New York doing fashion photography. I said, Jason, come on, now, drop this thing. Let's go to Afghanistan together. You're going to become a photojournalist. And he became a photojournalist in our two trips to Afghanistan.
Really?
The first one, when we crossed Afghanistan, Pakistan, Jason shot some amazing stuff. You can find it on his website, Jason Florio.
So he's just a natural.
It's natural, exactly. Yeah. It was waiting for him to, you know, turn his career upside down and become an on-the-road photojournalist. And then our second trip, 1 year later, we had a contact in New York linked to Massoud. He told the guys in the Panjshir, look, there are these two foreigners coming to interview the commander, please. And that's to get there, it's a novel how we got to the Panjshir Valley. But in the end, we made it via Tajikistan. We stayed there for 1 week. We went to see the prisoners of war, Uyghurs, Chechens, some Arabs as well, in Massoud's prisons. He gave us his last... It became his last written interview before he was killed. After that, he went to the front line. He gave an interview to a radio in France, and he was killed on 9/9, 2 days before 9/11.
Sure.
And it's interconnected. The killing of Massoud was interconnected with 9/11. So after that, Asia Times, okay, we had our journalistic place in world media, which coming from a very small website in Hong Kong was quite something, like a gift from a higher power.
You wrote, if I remember correctly, shortly after 9/11, a book called Globalistan.
Yes, Globalistan was published in 2007. It was a political travel book. He had everything on it, but especially at the beginning of the war on terror and the war on terror on the ground in Afghanistan, in Iraq, so from Central South Asia to West Asia. And this was based on the road journalism.
Yes, but
yes,
the term war on terror, what does that mean?
Exactly. It was called at the time GWOT. I don't know if you remember that. Global War on Terror. That was the official terminology. GWOT. Well, when we think that this was proclaimed on the day of 9/11 by Rumsfeld, by Cheney, by Bush, after they had a fateful meeting, if I'm not mistaken, it started at 11 in the morning in the White House, and presided by Cheney, by the way, because Bush, as you remember, was turning around, right? And this was coined only after a few hours when they had absolutely no evidence of what really happened. They had only a few hours to concoct a story, which by now we know, all of us know,
that
is an absolute myth, an absolute nonsense. But at the time, the planet was forced to abide by those war on terror rules. So the beginning of this millennium started with 9/11. So, and many of us who were on the ground following the global war on terror said, well, is the rest of the century that is going to be like that? Is this going to be a new American century ruled by their war on terror, or the way they see the war on terror? It didn't last long, as you know, and our audience now knows, right? But during the 2000s, that was it. And when Obama came to power in 2009, in 2008, I spent the whole of 2008 in the U.S., mostly on the road, but in the United States. And many of us, I would say all of us, we were fooled because we believed that Obama would end the war on terror.
And he still won the Nobel Peace Prize.
And he got a Peace Prize, You know what was the first foreign policy decision of the Obama regime, if we can call it, in early 2009 when he got to power? He ordered a surge in Afghanistan. And then we all saw, we have been, won't get fooled again, to quote The Who. We were fooled again. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but in 2016, Obama authorized something like 26,000 bombings in the Middle East.
You're absolutely correct. In fact, he bombed seven countries, which was more than Bush did. Bush 1 and Bush 2. Can you believe that? Now we can, because in retrospect, we have the whole, we have all the records to support our analysis. So we were fooled, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. But the global war on terror metastasized into the pivot to Asia. This was very, very important for all of us covering foreign policy. This was in the beginning of Obama 1. It was a State Department invention. The guy who invented it was Kurt Campbell. He was number two at the State Department at that time. Hillary Clinton said it was her idea. Bullshit. She stole it from Kurt Campbell. She wrote a huge piece on foreign affairs. Pivoting to Asia. We're going to start a new Silk Road. You know why I'm talking about this? Because this was the American version of the Silk Road. Hillary actually said, we are going to start a new Silk Road, and the focus of our Silk Road is going to be Afghanistan.
She said that.
She said that. She wrote about this. And this is beyond absurd. First of all, because Afghanistan was already trying to expel the Americans at the time. The Taliban would never accept being ruled by the Americans, and they were not. Afghanistan was surrounded, was totally isolated. There was no trade between Afghanistan and their Central Asian partners, or Russia and China for that matter. And the Americans jumped in and said, we're going to make the new Silk Road. So, well, this is typical stupidity of people who don't know about geography and history and on-the-ground realities, of course. But this marked a transition towards this pivot to Asia, which later on became what we are seeing now, which under the Trump, not much under Trump 1, but now under Trump 2, it's a war against several of the most important actors of Eurasia and linked to the Silk Roads. There is a trade, economic, technological war against China. There's a superpower war against Russia. There's a war of trying to exterminate Iran under the Islamic Revolution. So this is a war against BRICS, metastasized as a war against BRICS.
With the help of Israel.
Yes, go ahead.
With the help of Israel, with regards to Iran.
In fact, it's the same war, Jeremy.
Yeah.
At the moment, the way it's configured, the Trump-Netanyahu administration, it's the Zionist Axis war against the emerging Global South, and the top actors of the Global South, who happen to be, in many cases, the top actor in BRICS. We were born in two countries who are BRICS members, and against the SCO. So the top enemies is not by accident. The existential threats to the United States, recognized by the industrial military complex and the national security doctrine in the U.S., are Russia, China, and Iran. So this is how we metastasized from the global war on terror. Was never against branches of Islam. In fact, the way it was configured at the time was a war against Islam itself.
So when they,
but this was not the real enemy.
Yes.
It never was. The real enemy is big powers in Eurasia. And we are in the largest.
Yeah.
This is the largest power in Eurasia. So it's no wonder the Americans want to. So basically, they want to destroy
when
China.
When I asked you about the phrase war on terror, the word terror means this region that you're just referring to.
Now it does, but they don't apply a terror anymore. their terminology is malign actors. So China, Russia, and Iran are, by definition, malign actors.
Yes.
And they want to go against the interests of the United States, which means that they are against us. It's the same, you're with us or against us, pronounced by Bush himself right at the beginning. In fact, his screenwriters, right? And now we have, now we're naming names and naming nations.
Yeah.
And these three, they know very, very well. Of course, the Chinese are much more sophisticated than everybody else. They know that the United States wants to go against them, no holds barred. And they are preparing themselves for it. Sooner or later, there will be a conflagration. The Russians, because they are a nuclear superpower and a hypersonic superpower, they can take their time, and the Russians are excellent observers. They don't say much. When they say something, they mean it. You better take them at their word. They don't lie, and they are extremely patient. And they know that whoever is in power in the U.S., the American elites, they want to destroy Russia. And Iran is a much more... Let's say that Iran could be identified as the weakest link in this triad. But not that weak, as they proved when Israel tried to exterminate their regime, let's put it this way.
But, I mean, this then led to your next book, Empire of Chaos, isn't it right?
I wrote about this in the Empire of Chaos book, which was published in late 2014. Yes. In fact, it was launched in Beijing.
Is that right?
That's so cool. No? January 2015, we launched Empire of Chaos in a super cool bookshop in Beijing. And it was very pleasant to see because there were a lot of Asia Times readers there. And they were saying, look, we have been reading Asia Times since forever. People living in China or living in Hong Kong or businessmen moving around Asia and all that. And Empire of Chaos was more or less describing on the ground. It was a series of columns, most of them on the ground, the Obama era, which was preparing the terrain for where we are now, in fact. This pivot to Asia is we need to fight against the Eurasian powers over there, in their own terrain. So that's where we are now, and that's getting more serious by the minute.
But when you talk about the Empire of Chaos, the empire you're referring to is essentially the United States.
But not only. The empire is essentially the United States, but it's Atlanticist, as we see in the war on Ukraine. So we can define NATO as the big Robocop of the Empire of Chaos.
Yes.
And you have the subdivisions and you have the, let's say, the political arms. We can define the EU, as the EU functions today, as the political arm of NATO. Because the decisions are not made in Brussels by the European Union or in Strasbourg, the parliament in Strasbourg or whatever, they are, or in the European Commission, which is also in Brussels. The decisions all come from Washington.
Yeah.
And so this is how the system works. Decision-making, Washington, goes to NATO in Brussels. From NATO in Brussels goes to the European Commission, that toxic Medusa. I don't need to spell her name.
Yeah.
You all, our audience, you all know who that is. She receives her orders directly from NATO. And then these orders go to the European capitals. And in the case of London, it's more complicated because London is NATO, but London is not the EU. Doesn't matter. London is still, we can say, the most active member of NATO. And very important, the super rabid Russophobic member of NATO. It's not by accident that Sergei Lavrov, the greatest diplomat of our times, now he's saying openly, yes, the Brits are openly at war against us. NATO and the EU are at war against Russia.
Well, I mean, it was MI6 that drove the pipeline attack.
You mean the Nord Stream?
Yes.
It's a very complicated story, Jeremy. Okay, for the record, I am a big admirer of Seymour Hersh. He was one of my journalistic mentors when I was still in college. I said, I want to work like this guy.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. We don't need to explain. Sai is amazing. Sai has a Rolodex the size of Pluto, you know. He can call anybody in D.C. and say, look, let's see over there, what's your take? Can you point me to somebody who was at that meeting? So everybody talks to Sai. And the way he presented it, even if it was based in essentially one or two sources, top sources, but these sources were at the secret meetings that approved, let's destroy Nord Stream. I have not seen a single serious evidence contradicting Tsai's story. So his story is still, journalistically, he cracked the case based on his connections in D.C. And the guy who leaked that to him, he had no interest to lie because the guy was, in principle, this guy from the beginning said, this is complete madness. This is totally absurd. And he was against this. So that's why he leaked it to Tsai. And because he was an insider and he was at all these meetings, when we read Tsai's report, it's all there.
Yeah.
So in journalistic terms, this is beyond huge. And of course, as we all know, they tried to bury the story everywhere. And the Europeans are still trying to bury the story of this a yacht with an Ukrainian or a few ducks.
Yes.
It's stupid. So this was serious because it was even announced live by the Autopen administration, let's put it this way. If something happens, we have ways to finish off Nord Stream, which they did. But when you ask about MI6, MI6 is involved in every sort of covert operation against Russia, especially. Not necessarily against China. Yes, against China they are because they are involved in these Uyghur liberation movements.
That's more CIA.
That's most CIA, but there's also MI6. But MI6 is more concentrated in Central Asia and Afghanistan and against Russia. The fact that they are going more and more covert, CIA and MI6, because they know that Russia and China, they are too powerful for them. So the only way that they see it long term, okay, let's try to subvert little by little, incrementally and all that. And against Iran, they are going, you know, full speed ahead. And they go, if they do it against Iran, they're going to get not one bloody nose. They're going to be a serial bloody noses. But they still want to go against Iran again.
Well, that will be Israel that will get the bloody nose.
Essentially, yes. But if the Americans help Israel, get ready. The Iranians nowadays, those of us who have visited Iran recently and talked to IRGC generals or the best think tank analysts and all that. Now Iran is not afraid of anything. They know they will be attacked again. They might even be attacked again and again.
And they're powerful now.
Exactly. But they're ready. They have not shown all their weapons. And for instance, when we visited the IRGC aerospace development center in the outskirts of Tehran. In our case, we were a small group. We did that in May, which was 1 month before the Israeli attack. They showed us what they have, but they didn't show the secret weapons. Mm. And now we know that they have some extra stuff, which is absolutely lethal. So if the Zionist Axis tries something, could be even within the next few weeks. There's one strong possibility. Wow, this is going to be. But you know how exceptionalists think now. They think they're invulnerable. They are a mix of arrogance and ignorance.
Yeah.
Is unique. As we all know, we members of the Global South, we know that very well.
I just want to clarify something because this can easily be misconstrued as a hatred for all things America or the UK. It's not that.
Of course it's not, Jeremy. All of us, many of us analysts, we are Americans or people who lived in the U.S. and learned to love the U.S. on the ground. In my case, I learned to love the United States by living there and by traveling. I've probably been to 40 states at least, if not even more. And on the road, I am an on the road guy.
Yeah.
So I had a car and I went everywhere, literally. And the American population is good. It's a great people. And they are from everywhere.
But it's the government.
So there is an enormous distinction between great people, American citizens, everywhere in the Deep South, in the Midwest, in the Southwest, which I, geologically, we can even compare the Southwest of the U.S. with St. John.
Yes.
Some of the landscapes are, it's the same landscape.
They look the same.
Beautiful. With that, wow, that thing in D.C., which is a very provincial town. D.C. is very raw, crude. People are not very sophisticated. You have a few intellects, but basically they are a bunch of dumb bureaucrats talking to each other. You go to a restaurant in D.C., especially those restaurants near the Capitol Hill, they are talking to each other. You go to the big hotels, it's the same thing. There are meetings, they are talking to each other. So it's very provincial. Their view of the world at large is virtually zero. In most cases, it's less than zero. So what do you expect?
Yeah.
You know, they see the world through that, little cubicle in their minds, you know.
And they don't realize how powerful this whole Euro-Asia region is.
They don't realize how powerful China has become.
Yes.
And now they are freaking out. They are being overtaken technologically by China in every possible domain. It's when China launched the Made in China 2025 project 10 years ago, which was literally yesterday. The Chinese, very, sophisticated, very common, say, okay, we want to become either the leader or among the top two or three in these 10 high-tech domains. They're already leaders in 7 to 8, and soon they're going to be leaders on the 10th of them in 10 years.
Sure.
How can you do that? Only if you have a centrally planified economy with five-year plans, subsequent five-year plans. For instance, the Chinese have the whole thing mapped out at least until 2035, as we speak. And you follow your limits, the agenda, guidelines, etc. You fulfill this. It's meritocratic. If you have mistakes, you go over the mistakes. If you have challenges from foreign powers, like sanctions against Huawei, for instance. Huawei today is even more powerful than it was under Trump 1 when they were slapped with horrible sanctions. Huawei is a powerhouse today that the Americans have no idea.
Well, I mean, even whole pile of American products are made here, like Apple.
Absolutely. tell me about it. And now that this moderately prosperous Chinese society that we saw on the road on our trip, for instance, in small towns and cities everywhere across Xinjiang, with their state-of-the-art SUVs, their state-of-the-art smartphones, their state-of-the-art hotels, which are better than anything the West has to offer for excellent prices. This elite, or this rarefied oligarchy centered in D.C. with some points in New York, etc., they have no idea about that. And they have nothing else to offer, not only to American citizens and taxpayers especially, but to the rest of the world. And that leads us to the, what does the Empire of Chaos has to offer the Global South especially? And what does BRICS and SCO and the new Silk Roads and Infrastructure Bank and the NDB Bank, what do they offer to Africa as well?
A lot of
opportunities of development, loans with decent prices, building infrastructure everywhere. So it's the choice is so stark now between what the empire has to offer and what the global majority has to offer and has to profit from. For most nations, the choice is very, very clear. Unless you're a vassal.
Right, for
sure. That's another story.
I've seen a lot of criticism towards BRICS, saying that it's very flimsy. It isn't really anything. What are your views?
You have no idea, Jeremy, when BRICS started,
And BRICS started to gain a little more traction in the late 2000s, early 2010s. You mentioned the word BRICS in Washington, New York. They said, it's a joke. It's a talk shop thing, irrelevant and all that. Now they're starting to get the picture, especially after the BRICS summit last year in Kazan. And in the case of SEO, the SEO summit this year in Tianjin here in China. Now they're taking it seriously and they are terrified. Because people who still have a brain above room temperature, to quote our friend Martianov, it's one of his greatest expressions. People who still have a brain above room temperature in DC, now they're starting to see, yes, these people are getting together and they don't need us. BRICS, SEO, and most of the global south, they don't need the US for anything.
Yeah, so I mean, an example of that might be Russia and China not even trading with the US dollar.
Of course. And they are at 90%. Soon they'll get to 100. Everything is in rubles and yuan. And when you go to those forums in Russia, the top two forums, St. Petersburg in June and Vladivostok in September, the leadership, the business leadership of Russia is all there. And a great deal of the business leadership of China, India, Emirates, West Asia, they're all there as well. And they're discussing business, and this has nothing to do with the United States. And obviously, you see very few Americans, if you see any.
And Europeans.
And Europeans. I was in Vladivostok before I came to China over a month ago or so. I was expecting at least a relatively large American delegation after they start talking Russia and US. No. Practically zero American businessmen were there. So they were outside of all the deals that were being clinched. Hour after hour, they clinched over $80 billion of deals in 3 days.
So what do you see happening? What, I mean, give me a bit of a prognosis. No, not a prognosis. What's the right word?
Jeremy, I don't do crystal balls. This is something you learn on the road.
Yes.
Because the surprises are so cosmic in many cases, we cannot predict
Let me give an example. I see now South Africa, my country, with a large amount of Chinese cars coming in.
Yes.
And they're great. I think my next car will be Chinese because it is better priced, and it's just coming in with so much more stuff now than the European cars, which were great at one stage. But
Not anymore. And they are overpriced. And they are losing market. They will probably lose all the European market if they were not so protected. Fiat or Mercedes or Peugeot in France, when you compare them to the Chinese counterparts, come on. It's ridiculous.
So do you see BRICS acting as some sort of resistance against NATO or these separate entities?
It's different because it's not a military alliance. Still, the best definition is by Lavrov. Lavrov said, in fact, when he talked to us last year, Lavrov said, we should not turn BRICS into a very organized, stratified organization.
Oh, so he likes it decentralized.
He likes it decentralized and loose, and the fact that everybody has a voice. You can speak your voice in round tables anytime you want. The members and the partners, they listen to the partners. There are 10 partners among BRICS, and some are ultra important. The Southeast Asians are very, very important. There are two Central Asians, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, also very important. And everybody has a voice. The Africans have a voice. It's as important for them to listen to the Africans than to listen to Russia or China.
Yeah.
So this is what Lavrov likes about it, because it's a really democratic multilateral institution. We could argue that from now on, BRICS has to be more structured because the challenges now are, massive. Especially in terms of de-dollarization, which they never call de-dollarization.
Why?
Because they know that this would be a direct affront against the Americans.
Right, so they've got to be more subtle.
As you know, the Chinese are extremely subtle, and the Russians, they have probably the best diplomatic corps on the planet. They say, no, we are and when you listen to Wang Yi, or when you listen to Lavrov, they're basically always saying the same thing. We are increasing trade in our mutual currencies and multilaterally with our partners as well. Now, our objective is to trade using our own local national currencies amongst us and between us and our partners. This is a very sophisticated way of saying we are dumping the U.S. dollar.
Yes.
So once again, those who have a brain in the U.S., they can understand, oh my God, we are being expelled from this huge global South market. Yes, you are, but on a daily basis.
Okay, but then if BRICS isn't a response to NATO, then what is?
For the moment, we could argue that the SCO would eventually become an Asian NATO. They don't want it. If you talk once again to the leaders of Russia, China, India and Pakistan, which are both members of the SCO, Iran, member of the SCO, and the Central Asians, if you follow, for instance, Tianjin was very important. They never said that they want to become a military alliance. It's not explicit in their charter, which is very detailed, the Tianjin Declaration. It's a very important document. No, but we don't want foreign interference, which is a way of saying keep them out. But we have several problems when it comes to certain nation states. I'll give you an example. Kazakhstan signed a deal with the Americans to buy locomotives. Why they are not buying these locomotives from China, for instance?
And the next door.
Exactly. Next door, and Kazakhstan is a member of Belt and Road, of the New Silk Road. I'm not sure we're going to find this response in Astana or Almaty. Even if we ask directly, they'll never ask. And Kazakhstan is a very complicated, because they tried what in the past they described as multi-vector policy. This was under Nazarbayev. Now under Tokayev, they said, yes, we have a multilateral relations. And that includes the West as well. Of course, because the West, the oil companies are all there in Kazakhstan. But it's complicated because they are hedging all the time. And the Russians and the Chinese, the powerful neighbors, they look at that and I'm not sure they are very happy with this locomotive story. Mm. Because they know that this is Kazakhstan. It's a long-term contract. So you're going to have the Americans involved in the connectivity corridors inside Kazakhstan, which involve Russia and China directly. So these specific problems apply to specific nation states inside BRICS. This can be a problem in the long run. Saudi Arabia. Nobody can answer this question. Is Saudi Arabia inside BRICS or not? Nobody knows. Probably not even the Saudis know.
That's funny.
Because they received an official invitation. They said, we like it and all that. But they never made an official announcement we are BRICS members.
What do you think?
Once again, MBS is hedging.
Right.
MBS is a hedger. He learned that from MBZ in the Emirates. And who's also a hedger. Very complicated character. You know, some of my sources between Europe and the Persian Gulf, they know MBZ personally, and it's, I would say, it's not very uplifting, their portrait of MBZ, you know. And this is the guy who taught MBS everything he knows about politics, hedging all the time. And they know that if they don't hedge, the Americans can go there and destroy them. And take their money, because their money is, as we know, in London and New York. It's not in the Persian Gulf.
Yeah. Okay, Pepe, we are being summoned to dinner. So come in for a landing and give me a nugget of wisdom.
No, man, no wisdom. Come on, pilgrims have no wisdom. All right. we pilgrims, we learn. We are literally... It's no wonder that my most revered historical figure is a guy that we met during our trip. In many instances, because he was traveling here, leaving and coming back. Xuanzang, the monk in the early Tang Dynasty in the 7th century, who left the imperial capital, Shang'an, to go to India to recover manuscripts in Sanskrit and come back to China to translate them into Chinese. This guy is my hero. He's a pilgrim. It's a different story. We can become a geopolitical analyst or reporters or foreign correspondents, etc. But the way I see it, we should keep our minds always open to learn on the ground about everything, about culture, about history, about gastronomy, of course. Uyghur food, which is absolutely
delicious.
We can eat Uyghur food for the rest of our lives every day.
We're
going to have it now in our dinner, exactly. So this is not wisdom. This is, I would say, common on the road common sense.
You know? Pepe Escobar.
Thank you, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.